Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to episode 208 of Geek Town Radio. I'm back this week with Matt. How are you doing?
I'm good, David. How are you doing?
I'm very well, thanks. So what have you been up to? It's been a few weeks since you've been on.
Yes, it's been a little bit of time, but everybody sort of went on a break at once because
yes.
Becky went on holiday, then you went on holiday, and then
things
just kind of happened. So, but I recently this week started playing a Mario game, which is something you wouldn't usually hear from me. I don't like hate the character, but it's just not my preferred type of character. I've basically tried the... Now, Nintendo gave it this name, so don't blame me for the complicated name. It's called New Super Mario Bros. U Deluxe, and it's basically the combination of the Mario and the Luigi game, I think, from the Wii U, or some sort of packaged version with DLC and all that sort of stuff.
Right.
This is a Wii U game, hence the U that's probably on there for that reason. And it's called Deluxe because I don't think it's a port. I think it has got some sort of graphical upgrades and like some changes, but not like a full remaster kind of thing. It's been quite fun. It is kind of frustrating though, although I'm used to frustrating platformers, Crash Bandicoot. And it is a case where like you go to jump on a turtle or something and then you think, okay, if I jump on him and then you jump again but land on the other side, his shell will be shot the other way and I can use that to kill the other enemies. And then you go to sort of run and jump over something or even just normally jump and then you slightly mistime it and you turn into the small version of Mario or Luigi or some of the others.
Yeah.
And then like you think, oh, I'll quickly try it again. I can easily jump on this guy's head. You end up jumping into him and then you die, you start the level again. So there is that sort of frustrating thing. But it's both fun and frustrating, which again I'm used to because of Crash Bandicoot. But I'll continue to play it and see how far I get. So because I don't know how big the game is either. It seems to be fairly big. So I'll get along with it.
Usually are those. I don't play the Switch anywhere near as much as I probably should do. I've had one for a while and I don't know, there's something about it. I just don't play it that much. But then I don't play consoles that much either unless it's a console exclusive, you know. So
So that's been fun. I'll see how I get on with it. Speaking of Crash Bandicoot, he came back again with another remaster. This one was Crash Team Racing, or it's called Crash Team Racing Nitro Fueled because it combines the sequel, which was called Nitro Fueled or Nitro Kart or something. I didn't play any of that back when that was released, but I played some of Crash Team Racing. Basically, what it does, it takes some of the characters and some of the maps and puts them in a Crash Team Racing game, but it doesn't include any of the Nitro Kart stuff because that was the stuff that was, you know, criticized and they didn't want to put that stuff in. They basically found a way to put the good stuff from Nitro Kart into Crash Team Racing and make that a bigger game. And then you've got like the adventure mode and you've got Grand Prix and stuff, and it's quite fun at the moment. So I've heard a lot of people saying there's online issues with PS4, but I haven't played online yet, so I haven't experienced any of those.
Right.
Again, it's the same thing where you could be doing really well, you could be driving really well, and then you bump into a wall and Cortex drives past you and then you've kind of lost the race at that point.
Yeah.
Some people say, oh, you know, you don't always use Crash Bandicoot and you should use other characters. And I sort of said, I think last week on my podcast, like I only want to race as Crash Bandicoot because I don't want to win the race as Cortex or
Dingo
Dale, any of these other characters. But I get the point, which is some characters are like better with speed, but some characters are worse with turn or whatever. You can also put like these like different outfits and different skin things on the characters. I've just kept Crash Bandicoot the same. And I change his car every now and then again, though. So
yeah,
that's been kind of fun. But yeah, that's been all right as well. I'm kind of trying to jump between the two of them. Like when one gets really frustrating, go over to the other one and see how I get on with things. So The Wire season 3, I started it. I think I started on Saturday. I'm about 5 episodes into season 3 at the moment. I've seen obviously season 1 and 2. I think about a few months ago I came on the podcast and said I was halfway through season 2.
Yeah.
So now I'm back up starting with season 3. And season 3 really starts off kind of with I mean, the streets of Baltimore have always been like, you know, crime heavy and all that sort of stuff, hence all the police work and everything that happens in the series. But it starts off and there's seemingly this like gang war that's kind of happening.
Yeah.
And obviously Omar's right in the middle of it because he's one of the big names in the streets of Baltimore, because it shows you like, okay, life on Baltimore and then life of what the police are doing and how different things are. And it's an interesting kind of perspective. And again, HBO and The Wire and everything, it's very prestige television, I suppose you could call it. So that's been The Wire season 3. And then Superstore finally came back on ITV2. I think it's an NBC show.
It is an NBC show. Weirdly, while I was in America, I was in the Superstore.
Oh, okay.
Weren't around Universal, and because I was on the VIP tour, they actually let you off the car and to wander around the back lot a bit. And one of the places they take you into is the, you know, live sets or sets that are sort of currently set up and being used. And the set that they actually took us into was the Superstore set. And it's so weird wandering around the set because it is literally like wandering around a supermarket, because usually with those sort of places they don't put things like ceilings in because they have lighting rigs above and stuff,
right.
And you know, they're not usually as self-contained. You know, you'll have like a set on three sides and then there'll be an open wall or something. It's literally done as they take two sound stages which are next to each other, they've knocked them together, it's one massive set for and it is a supermarket inside. That's basically it, and the shelves are all stocked. Obviously there's not food and everything, although there are foods in some things, like, you know, if you've got clear bags of dog biscuits and stuff,
right,
they have to have bags of dog biscuits because you need to be able, you know, you can see what's inside
any sort of see-through container
you need to be able to see what's inside. That causes a slight problem because they're in the middle of area which has wildlife in it, and the raccoons will get into the Superstore set and pull the bags open because we were wandering around and we were like, is this set up for something? It's like, no, the raccoons have just got in and they've ripped open some of the bags of dog biscuits, and you can see little raccoon paw prints on the floor where they've kind of grabbed the dog biscuits and run off. So it was quite cute. But that was really fascinating because I've been inside a few sets before now, and I've never actually seen one that's set up quite like that. It's a really interesting setup there.
Yeah, I think they use, for some reason I didn't notice it until season 2, but in Good Girls, where they shop normally, the other NBC show, I'm pretty sure that's the cloud, because it's called Cloud 9, the shop.
Yeah, it could very well be, yeah.
I think it's the same one.
It wouldn't surprise me, because if they've got it set up already, it would sort of make sense.
The same network and all that.
Same network, same back lot. It would make sense to dress, like redress a few bits, and then, you know, because it's a Superstore set, so
you don't see the same characters. You see like extras or whatever wearing the outfits and that. But I'm pretty sure it's the same store. So.
Yeah, would make sense.
But yeah, Superstore is just a fun show, and they often, you know, they have sort of like a pre-scene and they have their intro, and then every now and then they'll cut over to a customer just doing like weird stuff, and it's just like, okay, is anyone going to catch this man or woman doing this weird particular thing? But yeah, they've changed a couple of roles around and they've pushed a couple of characters into like further into their sort of relationships and stuff. I don't want to say what those characters do because it will be a bit more spoilery. Even though it's for a sitcom, it will still sort of ruin the surprise of what happens. But yeah, it's just interesting some of the stuff that they get up to, and they still do the thing really well of having a through line for a story, which is mostly what the characters are doing, and then having like, you know, the odd like thing for that week sort of happen. They're still quite good at putting that together. But no, it's been a good season so far. I think it's been renewed for season 5. I've heard I saw little bits and pieces on YouTube like months ago that said the ending of season 4 is like darker than usual. So I'm interested to see what that means, because they've had like what's it, tornadoes and stuff near the store that have like ripped it apart or whatever. I think in the previous season or maybe in this season. So I'm interested to see what that is, basically. So,
yeah, interesting.
Yeah, got 3 episodes left. It will be finished. It's on every day as well, because I checked. Yes, because I didn't know if it was on a specific day, but it's actually on every day.
Right.
But yeah, that should be interesting. So
yeah, should be good.
What else have you been up to?
I've been trying to catch up on things that I'm got behind on while I was away. So Killing Eve season 2. I've started. I'm a few episodes into that now. It's not as well written as season 1, and that's probably due to the fact that Phoebe Waller-Bridger isn't writing the second season, I don't believe. So it is missing some of that. It's just not quite as good for the second season, which is a shame. But I mean, I'm still enjoying it. It sort of continues where the last season left off. It's pretty much a straight continuation. We'll see how that goes, but yeah, I'm not as impressed with the writing this season. Finished Designated Survivor season 3, which I really enjoyed.
I'm really struggling with this season. I got to episode 5, I think.
Right.
It was the 2 episode slot they did with the like controversial child marriage stuff.
Right.
I got past that, and then they did this other episode for something else, and then I was like, this isn't working. And then Jessica Jones was there, and then I was really in the mood to watch that, so I started that.
It's interesting because it has changed quite a lot. I mean, unlike some of the other shows, like Lucifer, you saw a few tiny changes, but you know, because both Lucifer and Designated Survivor were shows rescued by Netflix last season. Mm-hmm. And Lucifer, you saw a few tiny changes, but it was essentially still the same show. Designated Survivor has gone through some fairly large shifts in direction this season. They've kind of abandoned quite a lot of that conspiracy theory plot. It is still in there, although I mean arguably they don't actually line up until the end of the season, and up until that point it's almost like you're watching two shows that are mashed together, because they are like, it is like they're in a completely separate show, the characters on the one side, and then you've got like the sort of West Wing stuff, and then you've got the stuff that's the FBI CIA characters sort of chasing down this potential terror threat. But they are like, they're two entirely separate shows that have just been pushed together. It does eventually culminate in something, but it's kind of weird that. And the stuff that's at the White House has gone very much more West Wing. You know, there's a lot more walking and talking. It's a lot swearier than it has been in the past. there was an interesting thing they've been doing, which is using when they're talking about a particular issue, which is, you know, reflecting life in America, and they're talking about something like they talk about trans issues, or they're talking about drug abuse or that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
What is quite interesting is a lot of the footage they're doing of you know, because it's a campaign season, you know, Kirkman is trying to get himself reelected, and they're showing campaign ads and stuff. And when they're showing ads, the people that they're interviewing are genuine interviews with, they sent out documentary makers and have merged that in. So the people, the talking head bits that you see of people talking about various issues and problems are genuine. Those are genuine people that have dealt with whatever the issue is they're talking about. So I thought that was kind of interesting how they've merged that in. And it does add this sort of different level to it. Going to be interesting to see how that's gone across, because I suspect there are going to be a lot of people that are quite polarized by it. In, you know, like you say, you've been struggling with it. I actually quite enjoyed it, what they've done. But it is quite a switch from the first and second seasons. So it'll be interesting to see what the numbers are like and whether they bring it back again after that, because it has taken this sort of sharp change of direction. So I don't know. I am enjoying it though. I did enjoy that season quite a lot, but who knows whether it'll come back. You know, Netflix has a habit of cancelling things after 3 seasons, so I'll have to wait and see for that. I caught the first episode of Wild Bill, which is the ITV drama starring Rob Lowe. It's about this American police chief who seems to have left America under some sort of cloud, although it's not entirely sure at the start what exactly has caused him to leave. He's come to the UK and is in Boston, Lincolnshire, which apparently has the highest murder rate in the UK. Whether that's true or not, I don't know. I've not looked it up. But that has the most homicides in the UK. That was the sort of argument for him being there. And that, which, of course, compared to America, is nothing. It's like 5-10 people a year or something compared to America's statistics, which are going to be like about 40 times that. So it's sort of interesting to see. I mean, Rob Lowe is eminently watchable throughout it. It's quite funny. It's quite dark in places. It's a really interesting mix of a sort of American style drama, kind of dramedy mixed with an ITV drama, which is sort of what you'd expect from it. But it's odd to watch, but quite enjoyable. I've only seen the first episode so far, so I will watch the rest of it. I think it's only 6 episodes in total, so it could be quite interesting. And I don't know whether they're going to bring back for any more, because Rob Lowe has just signed a contract to do the 911 spin-off called 911 Lone Star US. So that's obviously going to be taking up his time, but given that this is only 6 episodes, it's chances are he could film more seasons of this on the off season, you know, so he could do the 911 Lone Star thing, which might be a 10 episode, could be a 22 episode season. And then he could do this in the intervening bits. So we'll have to wait and see. But I thought it was different and interesting and funny. And yeah, so worth going to watch, I think. And Jessica Jones, which I've started, I'm only a couple of episodes in, pretty much what you expect from Jessica Jones. I think interesting start to it. Hopefully it goes out and it ends on a high, because this is, of course, the last of the Marvel Netflix series. We'll see how it goes. There's been conflicting reports out there about whether, you know, she apparently made some comments about whether she'd come back, and she sort of initially apparently said that she didn't think she'd play Jessica Jones again. She sort of thought she'd done it now. She then sort of went back on Twitter and said she would play Jessica Jones again in a heartbeat. She's the coolest character I've ever played and I love her. You never know what the future holds. As for now, I'm proud of the long run and deep character work I got to do. It's been a dream, so never say never, which is slightly different to what she sort of said earlier. She sort of was saying, I think I've kind of done with it.
Possibility that she could have misspoken and said maybe, like, because even though it's a possibility these shows could end up on another Disney owned thing,
Yeah. Whatever
that is, that's not a guarantee, I suppose. So maybe she meant like, okay, no one's really sure what's going on right now and I think I'm finished.
Yeah.
But if she's then turned around and said like, I would like to play the character again, to me that just means she doesn't know if she will, but she would want to, I suppose. That's sort came across. Maybe
the initial thing was, I think she said, do I think her a player again? I don't think so. I feel like I've played her, you know, I feel really good about it. I feel good about closing the door, was what she originally said. So I, you know, it's one of those things. If it got revived in a few years, I'm sure she'd come back. It sounds like, from what she then said on Twitter, it sounds like she maybe had a word with her agent and then went back and sort of said, you know, of course I'm playing again. So we don't know whether those are ever going to come return or not. There is a possibility they might, but obviously all the actors are out of contract now, so it will depend what they're doing when the time eventually comes that they can. You know, Disney are allowed to actually put them on other channels, which, you know, we've talked about many times before.
They have to wait for that exclusion to expire.
There's an exclusion in the contract with Netflix that is like 2 years long or something before they can air it somewhere else. So
it's a long time.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. It is. So they may pop up somewhere else at some point, but at the moment we don't know.
However, I've finished season 3. I think I finished it like a week or two ago. Pretty good. It does still have the Netflix Marvel problem of like, okay, this should probably be 10 episodes instead of 13.
Right.
And some things do get a little bit stretched out, but for the most part, I enjoyed it. And I like the villain for this season. I won't spoil anything else to say about that, but better villain than last season. So although the villain situation last season was a bit more mixed and complicated, so
yeah,
you've got more of a sort of Kilgrave type where it's clearly more of a villain and less of a sort of like anti-hero in a way, I suppose. So I enjoyed it. It was pretty good.
So that's all the stuff we've been doing this week. Let's move on to some TV and film news. So we kick off the TV and film news this week with renewals, cancellations and pickups as ever. First one is one that I know Matt's been waiting for a very long time for news of. Scream Season 3, the TV series, has finally got a US air date. They've moved it on the networks in the US from MTV to VH1. At the moment, it's unclear whether it's coming to Netflix UK, because Netflix UK have the first two seasons of it. It would seem probable that they're going to run the third season, I think, but it depends on very much on the contracts behind the scenes. Basically, I mean, this was filmed years ago and it's been sat on a shelf because it was involved with the Weinstein Company, and it was tied up with all that stuff that happened after everything, all the accusations against Harvey Weinstein, which resulted in the company collapsing. And it was tied up with all that. And it wasn't exactly clear where the rights were going to end up. It's also not entirely clear exactly who Netflix UK had the deal with. So we don't know whether that deal has now ended and they might have need to sign something new, whether they had a deal for Scream Season 3. It would sort of make sense that now the rights have landed somewhere and that's all sorted out, then it would make sense for Netflix UK to pick it up, seeing as they ran the first two seasons. But they haven't come out, I don't think, officially one way or another, as far as I can see, to say whether they are airing it or not. If it does air, I think, as you said previously, it's likely to either go out next day or go out as a box set after the entire thing has aired in the US. Yeah. I think a box set is probably more likely in this case because they're running it out nightly.
Yes. Yeah, so three-night event, two episodes per night for three nights. There's six episodes.
Yes. So I think they're probably more likely to drop the whole thing as a box set, just wait the three nights out and drop the whole thing if they are going to air it. But that's an if. Mm-hmm. At the moment, we don't actually know.
Yeah. So a quick little timeline on this. The last episode that was shown was the Halloween special for October 2016. It was then renewed and everyone's like, oh, cool, we're getting Audrey and Emma and everybody else back. And this was the whole Brandon James cliffhanger thing, like a mini cliffhanger, but still a cliffhanger. And then they said, yeah, MTV said, yeah, we're going to renew it for a third season. It's going to be six episodes. And everyone kind of thought like, oh, this is six episodes to wrap up the current story. And then like a few months later, they said, oh, okay, we're going to reboot it. And everyone was like, wait, what? Why are you rebooting the whole series? And then so I was like, oh, so we're never going to see Emma and Audrey and all these other characters again. And then MTV just basically didn't say anything because they knew that they'd annoyed the fans a lot. Trust me, because I remember the time when that happened.
Yeah.
Because I've been following this ever since it happened, so I know most of the details. They started filming the season and then they said the ghost face would be coming back because they hadn't used the voice and they hadn't used the mask for season one and two. So all the fans were like, cool, even though this is a reboot, we're getting Ghostface back. Everyone likes that and everything. Yeah. So I think it was in the original films because they did four Scream films.
Yeah.
They put that out. Filming finished in November 2017 and it's now July 2019.
Yes.
So that tells you how long fans have been waiting for stuff. And there was combined total, there was at least a year of silence. There was a period when the fans sort of stopped talking on Twitter and were like, oh, we think this thing's just dead. You know, because of all the stuff with the Weinsteins, this thing is like dead, not coming out. And everyone was sort of mourning the loss of a show that had actually been filmed, was out there. It's not like this thing had not been cancelled or renewed.
Sat on a shelf. Yeah.
We weren't sure if it was coming back. Yeah. It was out there, which was the annoying thing. So yeah, it should be exciting to see what these new cast members are going to bring to Scream Season 3. The teaser trailer's out there. If you search for Scream Season 3, there will actually be a trailer on the internet. So
yes, there is a trailer out there.
At least we know the show's actually going to be on in a week. So
in America,
so it will finally be on a public screen in a week. So.
Yes. We'll have to wait and see what if Netflix UK pick it up and if they do when it turns up, but they've kept very quiet so far. I have seen one story saying that it's supposed to be coming soon afterwards, but I can't confirm that anywhere. There doesn't seem to have been anything official as far as I can see, so it may be one of those series that just pops up. It's going to be a case of keeping an eye on the social media feeds and we'll have to wait and see what happens. Staying with Netflix, there was an interesting story which has popped up in a few places just today. Neil Gaiman's Sandman, which is a DC title, looks like might be coming to Netflix as a series. Sandman is a comic book, DC comic book. It's one of his most acclaimed things. It's been floating around in development limbo for a very, very long time. I mean, literally decades. There's been various versions of films or TV shows kicking about. It was Joseph Gordon-Levitt who was supposed to be doing a film version that was announced about 3 years ago, and then he left the project over creative differences with DC, and there was adaptation in the works even before that. So it's been kicking around for a while. What's kind of interesting about this is Gaiman himself has a overall deal with Amazon.
Okay.
But the overall deal with Amazon is for Gaiman's original work, which is going to be either adaptations of his books or new things that he comes up with. Sandman, I suspect the reason that this can potentially go to Netflix is because it's controlled by DC. So that's why. I mean, you would have thought Amazon was the natural home for it, given that Gaiman has it in there already. But it sounds like that it might be going to Netflix if they manage to pull it off. There's various stories around saying they're close to signing a deal, so it's not like all signed properly yet, but it's sounding relatively positive that we might get a Sandman series. We'll have to keep an eye on that.
I saw this like popping up on obviously social media and stuff yesterday. I was like, oh, DC Sandman? Because obviously Sandman, a popular Marvel villain for Spider-Man. Yes. And I was like, oh, is there going to be like a... Because I didn't see the DC at first. I was like, oh, are they going to make like a Marvel villain series for Sandman? That's kind of strange, isn't it? It was like, no, Neil Gaiman's DC Sandman. And I was like, what is this thing? And I looked it up and I looked up images and stuff, and I don't think I've ever seen this thing before. So I'm interested to find out a bit more about it.
It's Sandman charts a long poetic arc over its original 75 issue run that followed the adventures of Morpheus, Lord of Dreams, a member of the pantheon of immortal beings called the Endless, who personify certain universal concepts that, along with dream, include death, desire, destiny, delirium, despair, and destruction. It's a sort of thing about various gods, which as you know, Neil Gaiman does very well. So, yes, it's an interesting concept. It's a very complex, quite dense comic book. It's something that would never really have worked as a film, so a TV series is always the better way to go. I just found it kind of interesting that it may end up on Netflix. I mean, Netflix is the type of company, I think, that would sign this purely to spite Amazon, you know? So
maybe, yeah.
So, we'll see if they do.
We are in the streaming wars, as they call them now.
Well,
so,
yes.
With everybody getting their things on the way and The Office leaving. Everybody's devastated about The Office leaving Netflix. So
Yes, The Office is leaving Netflix in the US. It's going on to, is it NBC's own streaming service.
Which
so there's that. Also on Netflix, there's an adaptation of another graphic novel. This one is called The Old Guard, but it's actually coming out as a movie version. The Old Guard is a graphic novel by Greg Rucka. It tells the story of a small covert group of immortal mercenaries who must fight to keep their team together when they discover the existence of a new immortal and their extraordinary abilities are exposed. Sounds like kind of an interesting setup. They've announced some casting for it. It's Chiwetel Ejiofor, who you'll know from various different things, such as Doctor Strange, where he played Mordo. 12 Years a Slave, obviously, is the big movie that he was in. He was also the operative in the Firefly movie, Serenity. He's voicing Scar in the live-action Lion King, and he's popped up in things like The Martian and Maleficent: Mistress of Evil. So there's a whole bunch of different things he's been in. But fabulous, fabulous actor. So that's a really good start. Veronica Engu, who starred in Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, Sword of Destiny. She was also in Star Wars The Last Jedi, where she played Paige Tico, sister to Kelly Moran Trans's Rose. She also appeared in Bright, the Netflix movie. And Harry Melling, who most of you will know as Dunstan Dursley from the Harry Potter movie franchise, although looking at him now, you would never, ever recognize him because he's lost an awful lot of weight from that chubby guy that
they've all aged and everything.
Yes, all aged. Yeah. And, you know, he's lost an awful lot of weight since playing that character in Harry Potter. He was recently in the Coen Brothers movie The Ballad of Buster Scruggs for Netflix as well. So they've also got Charlize Theron in there, Kiki Leia, Marwin Kenzerar, a few other people as well. So yeah, interesting. Another comic book adaptation coming as films. Netflix seems to be kind of jumping on things to either develop as films or as TV series from the comic book world, which is kind of interesting.
I think with them continuing to adapt comic book stuff is actually kind of important going forward, because seeing as, you know, Disney's going to come out with Disney Plus,
yeah,
and they're going to have obviously a bunch of Marvel and Star Wars stuff, which is going to still dominate the market. I mean, it is already. If you look at the cinema right now and this year, like, I'm sure 60% of it is Disney films. Yeah. So with Netflix, they do need to kind of look out there and still make like original stuff. They're still good at doing that, obviously. But looking at other comic books that people read, because there's tons and tons of comic books out there they can continue to adapt. So I think if they're going to do that as well as like their own original series and some other stuff, it's going to help them out a bit. Not that Netflix is in any danger, because there's still tons of stuff to watch on there. So we'll see how things go.
Yeah, and you've got your competition from, like we said, from Amazon, because they've now got all Neil Gaiman stuff.
Yeah, Lord of the Rings and that.
Yeah, you've got Lord of the Rings coming, and they've got a whole bunch of other sci-fi things that they're developing. You have got Millerworld over at Netflix as well, because they bought Mark Miller's Millerworld. So they're adapting a whole stack of his stuff into various different series and movies. So there is a lot of comic book adaptations out there, which is all good as far as we're concerned.
Is that thing, that upcoming thing, is it called Dark Crystal or something?
Oh yeah,
Dark something. I saw the cast list for that the other day, and that looks incredible.
Yeah, so the cast list for that is absolutely insane. I mean, it's all voiceover work, because Dark Crystal, as I'm sure many of you will know, is puppets. It's a Jim Henson thing. So it's a prequel to the movie, which, you know, it's a sort of classic film. The voice cast for that is everybody from like Lena Headey to Mark Hamill to, I mean, there's just this huge, ridiculous long list of names that are anybody who's anybody seems to be voicing something in that. That's good.
By the way, there's also a game coming out for the Switch soon.
Oh, is there?
Yeah, they announced it at the Nintendo Direct. So look out for that. I can't remember the release date they said, but that's coming soon.
Okay, interesting. And over on this side of the pond, Maisie Williams is going to star in a Sky One original comedy called 2 Weeks to Live, which is a comic tale of love and revenge born from a seemingly harmless prank that goes terribly wrong. A series of those revolves around Kim Noakes, a strange young misfit who was just a little girl when her father died under murky circumstances. Following his death, her mother whisks her away to remote rural life in seclusion and a bizarre survival techniques. Now all grown up, Kim sets out in the real world for the first time to begin a secret mission honoring her father's memory. Meanwhile, socially awkward Nicky isn't good at impressing girls, and when Kim walks into his and his brother Dave's local pub, it sets in motion a chaotic series of events that puts all their lives in danger. Who would have thought that a few drinks and an ill-judged prank could go so violently wrong? The setup sounds very much like that sort of comedy drama thing that Sky One seemed to do quite well. And Maisie Williams, it would be nice to see her doing something other than Aria. So, yeah, I mean, no other casting announced for that yet, but I thought that was kind of an interesting one.
Yeah, do you think that could have the type of feel of like Bounty Hunter, maybe?
I rather suspect it's got that sort of Bounty Hunter feel to it. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it is being pitched as a comedy, but it reads like a comedy drama, so we'll have to see. Moving on to larger news stories, it's a lot of video game things this week.
Yes, good. I'm happy about this stuff.
Yes, Final Fantasy is getting a live-action TV adaptation, which is an interesting one. Have you played the Final Fantasy games? They're not ones that I've particularly played.
I played about 2 hours of 15 and none of the others. So not too much, basically, no. But I will be trying the Final Fantasy VII Remake when that comes out.
Right, okay.
Next year, maybe. Yeah. I think,
I mean, Final Fantasy is a ridiculously popular gaming franchise. Oh, yeah. Final Fantasy XIV, I think, is the online one. And that seems to be the basis for the television series. It's a live action series, tells an original story set in the fantastic world of Eorzea, based on Final Fantasy XIV, the franchise blockbuster online role-playing game that has sold more than 144 million units worldwide across 3 decades. First debuted in 2013. It's inspired directly by the world and characters of the 14th installment. Project will embrace the bold and genre-bending sensibilities of the revered and long-running Final Fantasy series as it explores the struggles between magic and technology in a quest to bring peace to a land in conflict. Filled with iconic hallmarks of the title's revered mythology, the forthcoming series will feature a mix of new and familiar faces. Those will notably include the live-action debut of Cid, one of the game's central most beloved characters who has appeared in almost every installment of the franchise to date. I don't know anything about this world. I
don't either, to be honest. So I'm still excited for this. I've kept saying for like weeks and months on my podcast about The Witcher and stuff, and about how, you know, all these video game films that keep coming out, and not only are they not good, it's the case that, you know, when you have 2 hours or 2.5 hours, it's just not a long enough time to be able to tell these kind of stories. So if you have like 8, 10, 13 episodes or whatever, and you have more time and you get to season 2, 3, 4, whatever, it just gives you a lot more time to tell a story, especially something like Final Fantasy, which has got a lot of lore and characters and depths and stuff. And something like The Witcher as well, same kind of thing. It would be like, imagine if, so now that Game of Thrones is finished and that, it would be like if you tried to put the 8 seasons of the show into like a trilogy of films. You're going to miss some stuff there as well. If they came out with like a Final Fantasy trilogy, you still wouldn't be able to tell as much story as you could in a TV series. And I just think TV is going to be a better format for adapting games. And the first of which should probably be The Witcher, which hopefully comes out later this year.
Yes, it is supposed to be later this year.
And there's been a bunch of other announcements about like Showtime doing a Halo series, which makes sense as well.
Yeah, that's coming.
And some other ones, which we'll get to here in a bit. But yeah, I'm excited to see how all these TV shows get adapted, and I will be trying out all. See, even stuff like Final Fantasy, which I haven't played, I still want to watch the TV series just to see how they adapt things to the screen. So yeah, looking forward to it.
Yeah, at the moment they haven't actually given where this is going to end up. It's in development with Sony and Hivemind, who are the people behind The Expanse and The Witcher, and Square Enix as well, obviously, the game development company. We don't know exactly where this is going to end up. Amazon Prime and Hivemind have a deal in place, so it's possible it may end up there. But as with Sandman, this is obviously, the license to this is owned by Square Enix and Sony, I guess. So although Hivemind have a deal in place with Amazon, it's not their license to sell. So although they're developing it, that probably means it could get sold to pretty much anywhere, but likely it's going to be one of the streaming services that take it. So Amazon is a possibility, but Netflix may be a possibility as well. We don't know at the moment. We'll have to see where it ends up. Assuming it works and it goes to series, of course.
Right. They're only just put in development. So.
Yeah. Over on USA Network in the US, they have also ordered something which is video game related called Masters of Doom. As you might expect, that is about Doom, the classic first-person shooter game. Although it's slightly different. It's not going to be a TV series based on the Doom video game. What this is the story behind the scenes of the creation of the game, because that in itself is quite an interesting story. It's the true story of two computer geniuses in an obscure corner of America who, along with a group of rebellious misfits, created one of the biggest franchises of the 90s, the video game Doom. John Carmack and John Romero were best friends who became bitter rivals as they created a video game empire and transformed pop culture forever. So if you've ever seen, there's been quite a lot of things about the rivalry in the early days between Apple and Microsoft, and there was quite a big TV movie that was made about that as well. It has that sort of feel to it. Halt and Catch Fire, I think, is probably an interesting touch point, which is a show that went out on Amazon in the UK. So it's kind of intriguing. They're envisaging this as an anthology series with each season focused on a different pivotal moment in gaming history, which I find rather exciting as well. So
that's kind of cool, yeah.
So it may, although they're still calling it Masters of Doom, that only seems to be related to the first season. So whether it's going to be something Masters of Doom, like American Horror is American Horror, whatever,
and
it is.
Changes its theme or whatever. Yeah.
So whether this is going to be something Masters of Doom, I don't know. So it's going to be an anthology series, assuming it works and they move forward with it. It's only a pilot at the moment that they've ordered. It's been written by Tom Bissell, who serves as the exec producer as well. He was a writer on Gears of War, Battlefield, the brilliant Uncharted franchise. He's also various books, including Why Video Games Matter, co-authored The Disaster Artist, which was the book that was the basis for that film. He's written a bunch of short form fiction as well. So it's got an interesting writer about it that who obviously knows quite a lot about video games. So that seems like a fairly good start. I like the idea that they're sort of delving into the actual culture rather than just taking the Doom franchise and kind of trying to turn it into a TV series, which given that Doom was, it's a classic first person shooter, but there is quite a lot to it, I guess, but it's not something I particularly want to watch as a TV series. You know, it's fun to go in and kind of shoot things, but it's not necessarily, I'm not into those sort of horror things, so it's not something I particularly want to watch, but I'm sure there's many people out there that would.
Yeah.
But the story behind it, the sort of development stuff, I actually found quite geeky and interesting. So that I'm quite intrigued by, particularly if they have it as an anthology series and they're going to look at other video game things behind it as well. Interesting one, that. And lastly, we have Channel 5 are teaming up with PBS Masterpiece for a new adaptation of All Creatures Great and Small. So changing tack quite drastically with this story. So for those of you that don't know and are too young to know, like Matt, original, this is based on the James Herriot classic book series, or Creatures Great and Small. The original book series was written by veterinary surgeon Alf Wright under the pen name James Herriot, followed the heartwarming and humorous adventure of young country vet along with his unconventional mentor and cast of farmers and townsfolk who lived and worked in the Yorkshire Dales in the 1930s. However, the place where most people will know All Creatures Great and Small is from the TV adaptation, which ran from 1978 to 1990. It was a huge, huge TV series. Starred former Doctor Who Peter Davidson, Christopher Timothy and Robert Hardy in that. Channel 5 and PBS Masterpiece, who are the drama bit of PBS in the US, the public broadcasting service, have teamed up together for this new take, which is supposed to arrive next year at some point. Seems to have been a fairly mixed reaction to this idea of them remaking it, because as I say, a lot of people know it from the TV series. It was very beloved as a TV series, and with that original cast, all three of them, I mean, Peter Davison's certainly still around, Christopher Timothy's still around, I think Robert Hardy's still around as well. So you could potentially wheel some of those in for maybe some cameo roles, if not sort of main parts. You could have, whereas Peter Davison and Christopher Timothy played the younger vets, you could maybe have them playing the older vets in this version. I mean, it's Channel 5, and we've spoken at length about our opinion of Channel 5 on this podcast, but it's interesting to see them get into these sort of dramas. It's been written by Ben Vanstone, whose previous work includes The Last Kingdom, Merlin, EastEnders. It's been directed by Brian Percival, who was his lead director, who's also worked on Downton Abbey. So, I mean, they've got some reasonable names behind it. One of the producers of Silent Witness is in there. So I think that they're probably going to do a fairly decent job of it. The estate of sort of All Creatures Great and Small, the books and stuff, are now controlled by the children, and they're very, very protective of the father's work. So I suspect they would only have agreed to this if they thought that they were going to do a decent job of it. But we'll have to wait and see how it turns out.
See, when a story like this comes up and Channel 5 are involved in something, it's not, I try to hold back with the like Channel 5 judgment itself. But the other question that pops up is like, it's hard to tell how much money someone like Channel 5 sort of has. Because like when you look at the bigger networks, obviously HBO, Netflix, Amazon, all those sorts of things, and something gets announced for them, you know that there's a bit more money there. And like, but then when you go down to like Channel 5 and stuff, it's like, okay, how, it's hard to tell how good something like this will be from them.
Yeah.
Plus, it just seems like because they've been basically a reality channel for so long, it's just hard to tell how good they are at doing things anymore, if you get what I mean. So,
I mean, they do commission some original drama, but there's not a lot of it. And whilst I suspect there isn't that much money floating around, the fact that they've partnered with PBS, which again doesn't have that much money because it's a public broadcast service, but partnership together and the fact that it's not going to be that expensive to shoot, because it shoots in the Yorkshire Dales and it's about a bunch of vets, so it's not necessarily going to be horrendously expensive to shoot. But
because I don't want to keep turning around and going, oh, it's Channel 5, they're bad, it's Channel 5, they're bad. It's just hard to tell how good this is going to be because I'm not sure how good Channel 5 are at doing things at the moment. That's all. So
So it's coming next year, just so you're aware, really, and know to look out for it if you're a fan of the original, if you like vets, maybe. I don't know. We'll have to see where it, you know, how it ends up and when it actually lands, but we'll see. So that's all the news we have for this week. Next, we have the interview.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
The interview this week is with Ruth Barrett, who was composer of one of the biggest shows of last year, Bodyguard. She's also worked on a whole bunch of other things, City of Tiny Lights, the Harry Brown movie starring Michael Caine, S.J. Clarkson's Toast starring Helen Bonham Carter, Collateral, which was another huge BBC drama. She also works on Victoria, the Jenna Coleman series on ITV, and The Durrells, starring Keely Hulse, which of course is coming to an end soon. So I got to talk to her about a whole bunch of different things. She's a British composer, really, really fun and interesting to talk to. It was strange. I was actually in America when I did this interview and she was in London, which makes a change because it's usually the other way around. So here's the interview with Ruth. We will see you afterwards with some highlights for next week on TV. Start by saying it's lovely to have you come on and talk about your work and the fact that, I mean, you've got a CV which is ridiculous, and I'm sure most composers would kill for. Because Bodyguard in itself is a show which I think a lot of people would love to be involved with. But then you've got Victoria, Collateral, The Durrells, Critical, you did Whitechapel Hunted, Love Nina, Toast, just a ridiculous amount of things on there. And I mean,
don't get out much.
I don't know, where do we start? I guess you start with Bodyguard, because that was the main thing.
That was the hit.
there's a lot of hits.
They're all good shows. No, they're all brilliant shows. But I mean, it was just unbelievable how successful, you know, how many people watched it. I mean, I knew it was a brilliant show when I first saw the first edit, first assemblies of it. I'm like, oh my God, this is so good. Especially the first assembly of the train scene was just phenomenal to watch. I just couldn't breathe watching it. And I was like, okay, so I don't need to do much music for this. It's working really well. But of course, it wants music. And then it was like, what can we do to make it even worse than it is, you know, even 10 years? Which is, I love doing things like that. I just love, like, how can I make people feel really scared?
Yeah.
That's just such a fun thing to do. It's a really fun job.
So how did you get into composing in the first place?
Yeah, I mean, you know, in the 80s, I kind of grew up in the 80s with things like Freddy Krueger and Poltergeist. And I think I've always loved those kind of, the music was always really powerful in those kind of films. And I think I don't know if I was aware of it consciously that that's what I wanted to do, but I definitely used to love watching adverts as well. You know, things like a martini advert and
ah, yes.
are like really good tunes, and things like The Incredible Hulk. I used to laugh. I remember I used to cry at that tune.
You know what? We occasionally use the end theme of The Incredible Hulk. The sort of the walking, the sad Hulk music.
And I think I was about like 5 or something when I saw that. So things, music used to really affect me.
Yeah.
Especially TV music for some reason. And so I think it's always been with me. And then I guess I didn't really start writing music till I was about 15, I guess, because I met a professor, this mad Welsh amazing guy called Cyril Lloyd. And he kind of set me off. He told me I should go to the Academy, the Royal Academy of Music, and study with him on the Saturday, which is what I started doing. And then I just started writing this music and had an amazing piano teacher as well. And we used to improvise on classical pieces like The Rite of Spring. And we used to just take little riffs from it and then mess about with the riffs and just play music and just make up pieces in the moment. And I guess that's what really triggered off. That's how I write still, actually.
Right.
It's like I just mess around and I just sort of play things along with the picture and then just record stuff. I never press record. I just capture it afterwards, if you know what I mean, if that was any good. Or even if it was really rubbish, there might be a tiny bit of it that's got something. Because it's almost like you're not really thinking too hard about it. You're just kind of letting something fly in, letting an idea fly in. You know what I mean? If you put yourself on the spot and nothing comes out, if you're thinking too hard, I think.
Yes. Yeah.
And then I went off to Cambridge. I did a music degree there, but that wasn't so great, I have to say. Yeah. For aspiring, it was all a bit quite an academic course. But the good thing was that you could do all this music for theatre and music outside of the course. And I met loads of really great players, and I did a lot of work in theatre. And I think that's what sort of kicked off that idea of writing for a narrative and giving something an atmosphere. And I was just hooked on that. So when I left, I'm like, that's what I really want to do. But there's so many different things you can do in music, like documentaries, dance, films, drama, and you're like, and it's really hard to know how to get into, how do you get into that sort of thing?
Mm.
And if you don't know, if your dad's not Steven Spielberg or whatever, then how do you meet the people, you know?
Mm.
I did a variety of things, like temping jobs to just get in record companies, and eventually ended up in ITV and started working there. And I met my husband there, who was an engineer, and I started sending demos to people in the edit suites and got jobs like that. And then I met an amazing composer after a few years, I started working in a recording studio, second job, and he asked me to go to a session of his, which was a period drama. And so I heard an orchestra playing along too. It was North and South. And I just absolutely fell in love with the music that he'd done and the pictures, and just like, get a grip. This is what you need to do. Get on with it. And he asked me to start writing, like shadow writing for some of his projects. And that's what really got me onto the drama department. And he's like a mentor, I guess. So everyone needs somebody like that in their lives. And for me, there's been a few key people who've sort of unlocked the next level. And then you have someone who believes in you, then they can usually persuade the people, like the directors, to hire you, you know, and you haven't done much. They go, yeah, it'll be fine. And if it isn't, they kind of vouch for you. So that's what he did, which was really amazing, actually. So that's how so I've worked with Martin on quite a few jobs. And then, you know, and that's how I've started to get my own jobs.
Hmm. Yeah.
So it's like one thing leads to another, you know, once you've got one, then usually if you don't completely screw it up, then somebody in the production might want to hire you again, you know.
Yeah, that mentoring thing seems quite common and popular, particularly with the composing world, in that quite often you'll find that somebody's gone through either there's a massive school in Santa Monica for Hans Zimmer where they kind of cultivate all that sort of stuff.
Yeah, all right, in teams now and groups. It's collaborative.
Yeah, and then there's Blake Neely as well, who does the all the CW superhero shows, who started out as a sort of single thing with people ghostwriting
some of the stuff or assistant composing. And now if you look through all the credits on that, they're all Blake Neely and somebody else who've been there sort of pretty much from the start, but they're now co-crediting.
You have to work up to getting co-writes, I think. And it has to work well because, you know, you need a few things under your belt before I think you can kind of claim something like that.
Yeah.
Because it's quite a different thing to be the one in the hot seat who's actually your ass is on the line.
Yeah.
You know, to share that with somebody else. It's a hard one to do.
Yeah.
Yeah. Once you've earned your stripes, then fair enough. But
totally.
But it worked really well. Yeah. I've collaborated with other composers, like on Victoria and on the Durrells. I co-write with John Wigan. So it can work really well, and it's fun. It makes it more fun because often a lot of the time you can be on your own, and when the shit hits the fan, you know, it can be a lonely place. There's been lots of t-shirts ripped, phones thrown on the floor, glasses thrown on the floor and stamped on. Like, oh no, why did I do that? Now I can't actually see the computer. You know, tears, right, irate, conversations with directors sometimes. It can be really fraught. But fun. But so if you've got other people around, then it can make it slightly easier to deal with.
Yeah, no, totally.
You have to grow a thick skin in this job, you know?
Yes, I think that's very true. I mean, some of the, particularly working in TV, maybe less so in the UK, but certainly the US network TV, when they're doing like 22 episode runs and you're sort of, you know. The pressure on that must be insane. So
just the schedules with the American stuff, I think the schedules are so much tighter as well.
Yeah.
So there seems to be reams of execs, you know, when you look at the credits of things, you're like, oh my goodness, are they all going to be on a conference call, like 25 of them?
Yeah, that must be horrendous.
I haven't been in that situation as of yet. It's usually one to three people who've got you by the throat.
I mean, presumably that's the directors and producers. I did notice S.J. Clarkson pops up quite a lot on your on your projects.
Yes, who is fantastic. I've worked with her since Whitechapel was the first job that I worked with SJ on, and then we've worked together several times since. And she works in the States an awful lot, but in the States the directors don't tend to get to choose who to work with, even if they're directing the first episodes, which she often does. She did Jessica Jones. It's usually the showrunner who makes those decisions, and the director spends literally just shoots, not just literally, but you know, they shoot the show and they maybe have a week in the edit and then they're out. So we'll see. But she's doing some amazing. She's doing Game of Thrones, the prequel. So
yes, yeah.
So, I'm waiting for my phone to ring.
I was going to say, I'd be there, sat next to it, going, ring, damn you.
Yeah.
She's supposed to be doing on the movie side, she's supposed to be doing a Star Trek sequel as well.
Yeah. Well, again, watch this space, guys, you know.
if it ever materializes, because they can't get Chris Pine to do it at the moment. So, you know, we'll see. But
that's it. Things will drag on a bit.
Yes.
I can get a couple of movies under my, couple more. Then, you know, maybe then I'll get picked.
Yeah, maybe then you can get a chance to play around with the Star Trek theme. That would be awesome.
Well, Jeff Russo's done the Star Trek TV series, so he's done fantastic.
Yeah.
So you've got that as well to compete with.
And Jeff did an amazing job with that as well.
Oh, he's brilliant. He's fantastic.
In terms of some of the other things, I mean, Victoria, when you're coming to a show like that, which is obviously a very different sort of soundscape to something like Bodyguard, how are you approaching the music for that? Do you go back looking at sort of music from the era when it's an actual historical drama?
Sometimes. Not really, to be honest, with Victoria. I mean, it was already set up because Martin Phipps did the first episode and the theme tune. So he established a bit of an identity for it. And then I had to obviously take it on a journey. And I knew that it needed an orchestra because it needed to feel epic. And they didn't have the luxury of having lots of landscapes and exteriors. It was a lot of very beautiful. I don't know if you've seen the show, but it's very opulent interiors. A lot of the interiors are opulent. So it needed to have that sort of sense of scale, I suppose. Ooh. Yeah, I do like looking back into it and finding some nuggets in the classical music repertoire, you know, and then thinking like, because on the last series, Victoria's Sister pops up and I use a bit of Vivaldi for inspiration for that. So you can take little bits and then sort of just do whatever you want with it, really, because it's up for grabs. He's been dead long enough, you know. Should be giving away my secret. Actually, it wasn't Vivaldi. And, you know, we've got some modular synths in there as well, because there was a revolution.
Ah.
And, yeah, got some toms, got some kick drums in there and some... You know, my husband's a bit of a modular synth nut, so he gets locked away till he's made some ear bleeding noise. And then I kind of pull that in, go, oh, yeah, if we can get this in Victoria,
yeah.
Oh, yeah, that's going to be great.
That's what you want.
If the execs are listening right now, they'll be like, hang on a minute. Where's this noise? They probably think I've put it on the American episode, so they might not have seen.
Right. Oh dear. So speaking of things like modular synths and stuff, is there a particular odd instrument or thing that you've used to create a sound that's then ended up in one of your scores?
Oh, so many. Yeah, I mean, Bodyguard was a trombone, a flute, some tribal vocals and synths. That's, and a cello, a scratchy cello. That's what it is.
Right.
There's nothing else in it. Maybe a couple of piano notes.
Yeah.
There's nothing. It's all synths and trombones. There was a membrane flute with a cling film, a hole with a bit of cling film on it.
Right, okay.
I've never seen that before in my life.
Interesting.
It makes a really sort of distorted sound when you play it. Well, I didn't play it. Anderson did it, but... And I just got him to, because I had the theme was one of the first ideas that came about, which was this kind of like, what do you do to connect the idea of this terror and panic and this sort of actually it's an action show and then also this desire and weird relationship that David has with his with the woman that he's protecting, which is quite sexy and compelling and out of control, and this sort of throbby sound, this synth sound, like the big kind of bass kick of the SH-101 basically, and then that's kind of what that kind of kicked it off, like. And also something that's a bit, not too serious, you know, a little bit like a club or, you know, and then building up the sounds of just like, just throwing things in, just crazy vocals, a scream, you know, just things like, what is this guy's is going on in his head, all this crazy stuff. And Thomas, the director, really loved creating some, all that kind of scratchy, strange, weird sounds. He was really into that. He really pushed that because initially I was thinking, oh my God, this is a wall of noise. You can get away with this. They're gonna, but they never wanted an orchestra. They didn't want it to be epic. They didn't want it to be, you know, we're trying to do James Bond here.
We wanted
to feel realistic because it's something that could happen to anyone being on a train and then there's a suicide bomber in the toilet. No one wants that. They didn't want to do it in a style that would be like, oh, we're watching an action film and we're going to be taken on a ride. It's like, no, this you want to be properly scared. And I think that opening scene is terrifying, you know. And I think musically, you almost don't notice, well, probably because it was mixed so quietly.
You sat there going, turn me up.
Turn it up. Because it's quite.
I spent ages on that.
Yeah, well, a lot longer than they spent on the sound. it's BBC.
Yes, yes. I mean, it is such an amazing open scene. That I mean, really quite phenomenal.
Yeah.
And I mean, we don't know whether they're actually going to, well, I think they probably are going to do more Bodyguard, but I know that they've officially said exactly what they're doing yet. So, you know.
Yeah, Jed's talking. I just don't think he's written it yet.
No, I think there's, it's not like.
I've got ideas floating around, but he's got a lot of stuff. Got another Line of Duty to do, hasn't he?
Yeah. It's like he was kind of. People were complaining last year because of the fact that, oh, what's this Bodyguard thing that he's bringing out because it's getting in the way of him bringing back Line of Duty. And Line of Duty fans so upset. Then Bodyguard comes out. They're like,
yes.
Oh, no, we've got to wait for the next Line of Duty before Bodyguard.
Yeah.
Sort of flipped.
I know, there's only one of Jed. So.
Yes, unfortunately, he's only one genius instead of two. So.
I'm not sure we could cope with two Jeds, though.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
He knows what he likes.
Yes.
He's fantastic to work with. Which I love Jed's writing.
Which is killing people and setting up most distinct.
Yeah, doing the unexpected. You know, people were desperate for Julia to come back and she just didn't.
Yeah.
And he won't bring her back in series two. You know, it's not like the Bobby in the shower scene. Whatever it was.
Yeah, speaking of Julia, actually, I mean, the other show that you were doing was The Durrells as well. You see, at this point, I think if you're kind of not doing anything, you know, there's no TV show on the horizon, you could just offer to follow Keeley Halls around writing her life in music.
Yeah, I know every facial expression for Keeley. Yeah, I think Keeley's phenomenal. I mean, it's so brilliant to work on, you know, shows and meet her as well. And they were really close together because I saw her on at the rap party for Durrells, the final one, and that Bodyguard had just come out and she looked pretty wide-eyed. the Paps were outside her house, you know.
Yeah.
It was really intense. I think no one really was prepared for that.
Yeah.
So, I think I was doing Bodyguard at the same time as one of the series for Durrells. So, but that's good because it's that they're so different. You're not going to get mixed up.
I would hope you're not going to get those mixed up. That's a very
from the Bodyguard on the Durrells and just that's going to sound like. Yeah, that'll make them fall off their chairs.
Yes, there seems to be a sniper's loose on Corfu. Seems, you know, unlikely.
At times, there's, you know, well, the last series, it's the war is coming.
Right, yeah.
But we tried doing a war theme, but Sally, the exec's like, oh, no, this is too gloomy. You know, this isn't Durrells. So it's not right. You know, you can have tension, but it's got to be done in that mandolin Greek way.
Yeah, I was going to say, where does the inspiration for the Durrells stuff come from? Is it sort of looking at Greek music and that sort of thing? A little bit.
We looked at Rebetika and some of the Greek, more traditional like Greek music. As the series went along and they spent more time in Greece, we thought we'd go deeper into the Greek world. Because it started off, it's almost like they're a little bit, not necessarily British, but a bit more of a melting pot of styles. And I was going with on the first series with more of a like gypsy folk. I was really inspired by some of the stuff Sam Lee's been doing and that wild, like the wild, something that sounds a bit wild and folky. That's what it started off with. And Greek choir. We had Greek choirs on it in the first series and some brilliant singers. So the end song was, I mean, that came together really, really quickly. But the tune is really, it's almost like a pop tune or something. I was trying to do something that was quite happy and we're so happy to be here. And, you know, just that naivety almost that they had in going there, but that they were really brave to go there as well. But they just didn't really think it through that they were going to be in this cold house with no electricity. Well, not cold, it's warm in Greece, but there's no electricity.
Yeah.
Quite different. And then meeting Manos, the guy who sang the song, and his wife, well, his ex-wife now, unfortunately, nothing to do with me, wrote the lyrics for it, which are beautiful for the end credits. And he sang it with some mates and it was sort of a mixture of the Greek and the British sort of thing. But then as we went through, we used a bit more of we got a Greek children's choir on the last series, which is just really magical. We recorded them in a church in Corfu.
Oh, cool.
Just an excuse to go out. They're amazing. And I used them in Victoria as well because they were so good.
Oh, wow. That's cool.
Yeah, so the bit of the Greek crept into Victoria along with the modular synths.
They
used to it again and... Where did they come in?
Yeah, it must be so tempting. Like, you know what would sound good here? A Jamaican choir recorded in Jamaica.
Yeah, that would be really good. I've never recorded anything there. Love to.
Yeah, somewhere, you know, I think the acoustics for this would be great in a vineyard in the south of France.
Exactly. Maybe we need to base everything around the location.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
I don't know why. Yeah, Scotland maybe. the latest thing. I mean, I'm up in Scotland, but that's beautiful too.
Yes. Well, yeah. Scotland's its own beauty. It's just not very warm.
Not hot. Yeah.
So.
Yeah. No. Foo was fantastic. Yeah.
Yeah. So, what else have you got coming up then? Is there anything you can talk about?
I'm working on a new Jane Austen adaptation called Sanditon. It's going to be on ITV, And it's really exciting because we're not doing it in a traditional way, but it's not electric guitars or anything weird like that. It's, you know, just unpalatable. It's kind of, it's heavily folk influenced, I'd say.
Yeah.
It's kind of got a bit of rock and roll going on, but that could be plausible for the period. So we've got citterns and Celtic harps, folk fiddles and cello, but it's a band basically that I've handpicked from the Highlands who are absolute superstars in how they play. So all the ball sequences are, they appear in them, and it's wild. It's like a kind of wild shindig.
So it's, oh, that sounds awesome.
I use them in the score. So it's got this through line with the band playing the score, and then they're in the ball sequences as well. So there's this kind of cohesion in the music. And it's great. It's going to be a really sexy show. It's going to, hopefully going to come out in the autumn somehow. Where are we now? June.
I could see the colour draining from your face now.
Never that one, yeah. In fact, playing it on Friday to the head of the company. So let's hope she likes it.
Yes, that would be good.
It's brilliant working with Ollie Blackburn, who I met in Victoria. That's the thing, when you're working on different shows and you meet different directors, and then they go on and do other shows that are completely different in style, but you get on with them. That's the thing. I love doing different styles, but it's not through choice particularly. It's because you gel, you have a chemistry with somebody, and then you collaborate and you just make something that's right for the show. And it doesn't really matter if it's crazy synths or it's panpipe or it's, well, maybe not panpipe actually.
What have you got against a panpipe?
Quiet. You know, the more out there, the better. It's just about finding what's at the heart of the show. And yeah, Ollie just keeps sending me crazy references. And
that's awesome.
From like the 70s generally.
Yeah.
And, but people who I absolutely love, like Morricone and Lalo Schifrin, and, you know, that sort of style of music. But it's just, I just love films from that era because the scores are just completely.
Yeah.
Out there, you know, it's all those Clint Eastwood films, and just brilliant to do something like that, you know, that's really bold. So I guess that's the ambition for this Sanditon score, is it's bold, you know?
Mm, yeah, that sounds fascinating. A
score that's just gently massaging, you know, the scenes and just giving it a tone. It's smacking you around the face. Well, gently.
Tapping you around the face.
Tapping you around the face. We'll see how loud the dubbing mixes it, shall we?
Oh dear. Well, that I am looking forward to. That sounds absolutely fascinating. I'm really interested to hear that.
Yeah. There are, and hopefully the Austin fans won't be too up in arms, because we've hidden some gems in there, some Austin classics, favourites in there.
Cool.
They may appear exactly as you've heard them before, but they're in there. So we haven't reinvented the wheel. Well, they won't
entirely.
Be. Oh, it's not everything's done for a reason, and we've thought a lot, you know, long and hard about the best way to sort of show this, because it's not a place that anyone's really seen before, because it was an unfinished novel. It was her last novel before she died, so it's a bit racy for Jane Austen,
right?
Andrew Davis has made it even more racy, of course. And it's a seaside town, and it's a bit like Vegas, you know, how that might have been if it was in Britain. Maybe not quite as wild as Vegas, but all the rich folk go down to Sanditon to get their kicks, you know.
Right.
And it's a place where anything can happen. And you go for the sea air, you go for health reasons, but you also go there to get drunk and have fun. And the rich and the poor are mixing together, and there's all these relationships, and it's fascinating. It's a really good, fun story.
So, yeah. Well, that sounds awesome.
To work on, and I just finished recording with the band just a few, 3 days up in Scotland, and they rocked it. So it's really, cool. Really exciting.
Yeah, that I'm very much looking forward to. That sounds fascinating. So last two questions. First question is, what TV shows are you watching at the moment?
Oh, God, Killing Eve.
Of course.
Oh, my God, I love it so much. It's just the best.
Yes.
It's just, oh, hilarious, yeah. Brilliant music. We binged it when we were in LA a couple of weeks ago because it came out there first.
Yeah.
But I didn't watch the final two episodes, so I was with my cousin Sam, my brilliant cousin, and she. I've got to get together with her, so we really need to see the final two episodes.
And
it's out. So
yes.
But yes, I love that show because it's just. I find it really empowering to watch it because the women in it are just so unapologetic about everything they do. And they just do whatever they want, which is, I just find that inspiring. Yes. And I think the two main characters in it are just brilliant. And the fashion in it is brilliant too.
And last question, if you had the opportunity to work on any TV show, past, present, or something in the future, which show would it be? And it can't be one you've already worked on.
Oh, well, I think maybe I'd have to go back to the 70s and do one of those cop shows from the 70s. Maybe Knight Rider. Maybe I'd like to do that.
Yes. Yeah. Knight Rider.
And then you're fighting for something that's already so iconic, but.
Street Hawk. Everybody remembers Street Hawk, but nobody remembers the name, the like music.
Maybe do something that's not as so iconic, but has that same thing. That would be good.
Manimal.
And even better. Otherwise, you're watching, oh no, it's the original was better. No.
Yeah. No, that's always the danger. But
I love doing something really creepy, like Le Revenant or something like that.
Ah.
That would be good.
Yeah.
Something really.
Get into the horror.
Yeah.
Awesome.
I like scary stuff. And I haven't really done anything outright horror yet.
Okay. Yeah, I suppose.
Please offer me something like that, is listening.
Yeah.
A Don't Look Now type of series, you know?
Yes, that would be an interesting one for you to
not
do.
Not necessarily really gory, but sort of chilling and suspenseful.
Yes. If you don't do gore, you don't want to be scoring something like that because you'd be like watching through your fingers.
But it's creating the feeling of watching through your fingers, but there's nothing happening.
Yeah.
That's, I think, would be really cool because the music, it's like in Psycho, nothing's happening for a lot of it, but the music makes you feel sick.
Yeah.
You know that he's going to kill her. You know, something's going to happen and you don't know when. And it's the music that's doing that. It's just working and working and relentlessly kind of teasing your subconscious, you know, tickling away. And I think that's what it's really exciting to do is, nothing much is happening and then you've got to tell the story. That was what's good about doing Bodyguard is there are a lot of scenes with Richard's face and him looking into who is Julia and figuring out that he really can't stand the woman. And then musically saying that, like, that realization, sort of telling that story slowly that he really, really can't stand her. And there was nothing else going on and there's no talking. And that's what's very pleasurable to do, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
You're connecting with the audience on that level, you know, you've got that role to really connect with them.
Yeah.
And that's just, I think that's just thrilling.
Awesome. Well, it's been fabulous. I've really enjoyed this.
Enjoyed talking to you.
It's been really fun. Great. Have a great day. It's been lovely to talk. Next time you have something come out, come back on and we can talk about that again because
That'd be brilliant. Love to do that. Thanks.
It'd be wonderful. Yeah. Awesome. Well, have an awesome day and I will talk to you soon. Cheers.
Cheers, Dave.
Bye.
See ya.
So that was the interview with Ruth Barrett. Hope you enjoyed that. Bodyguard, of course, I think pretty much everybody who's going to see that has probably already seen it. I think it's on Netflix.
It may still be, yes.
It's on Netflix. And I don't know whether it's still kicking around the iPlayer, but it is definitely on Netflix.
It should be.
Collateral is worth looking up if you've not seen that. Victoria, of course, on ITV and The Durrells on ITV. Now we've got some highlights for next week on TV. So highlights for next week. We have For the People returning for its second and now last season. That's the Shondaland courtroom drama. Oh, I quite enjoyed it.
Already?
Yes.
Final season already?
Oh, yes. Okay. They announced that was canned. That's coming to Sky Witness on the 3rd of July at 10 p.m. Rare kind of misstep for that gets cancelled, but For the People is coming back.
if you want to watch the second season of that. Legion back for its third and final season. That is on Fox on the 4th of July at 9 p.m. Happy Treason Day to any Americans that are listening for this week. Ungrateful colonists. That obviously sees the Marvel X-Men character back. This season has Professor X showing up in it as well, so it could be worth watching. Hopefully it's a little bit more coherent than the second season, because the second season really went off the rails.
I mean it kind of has to be if it's the final season. They kind of have to bring everything to an end then.
Yes, it's how they managed to do it. Second season got very, very incoherent in places, and first season handled it quite well, second season not so much. So hopefully the third season pulls it back more to where the first season position was. But 4th of July on Fox at 9 p.m. for that. Stranger Things back for its third season. That is also on the 4th of July. I'm very much looking forward to that, because that's been a brilliant series throughout. Divorce, that is the Sarah Jessica Parker series. That's back for a third season on Sky Atlantic on the 8th of July. That's at 10 past 10. And Last Man Standing, the Tim Allen sitcom, that is returning to 5 Star for its 7th season. That's on the 9th of July at 8 p.m. Didn't know whether we were going to get that back, because it moved from ABC in the US to Fox, so we didn't know whether that was going to come back or not, and it's on 5, so it's always a bit of a roll of the dice whether they pick something up again. But they have picked up the 7th season of that. That is coming 9th of July at 8 p.m. on July 9th. So that's everything for this week, unless you've got anything else you want to mention.
Come follow me on Twitter at eTalksUK. That's where you can get updates of course when things get posted and stuff. Classic Reviews is on a break at the moment for the first half of season 2, I suppose, and that will be back on the 21st of August. I guess if you want a time for that, it's at 1 p.m, which is obviously very different to when these shows come back. It's just because we still got iZombie running and I want to sort of separate the two a bit. But that's Classic Reviews at the moment. eTalkUK on Twitter.
Go follow Matt. Oh, and go and check out Bex as well. She started Twitch streaming live, so keep an eye on Trista Bytes. That's Bytes with a Y, because she started doing quite a lot of live streaming on Twitch. Started off with a very funny Q&A last night, and she's doing more stuff tonight, and there'll be more stuff going out throughout the next few weeks and months. So go and check that out for her, and go and subscribe to a Twitch feed. Obviously for us on geektown.co.uk, you can find all the latest news and air date information. If you want to get in touch with your questions and comments, email us on podcast@geektown.co.uk. Leave a message on the website post. Find us at Geektown on Twitter, on Facebook at facebook.com/Geektown, on YouTube at youtube.com/Geektown, and on Instagram at GeektownUK. That is everything. We shall see you next week. Bye-bye.
Goodbye.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
It's the question that's on everyone's mind. How do you live a good life? Is it about work, health, or relationships? What about happiness, meaning, and money? What really matters? And how can you dramatically improve all of these things? These are the questions we explore every week on the top-ranked podcast, Good Life Project, hosted by award-winning author and perpetual seeker Jonathan Fields, which also happens to be me. Every week, I sit down with world-renowned researchers, experts, and scions of art and industry on the Good Life Project podcast. This week, in fact, we're sharing a fantastic conversation with the author Elizabeth Gilbert about a single practice that changed her life. Listen to the Good Life Project podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.